So we're going to talk about the book of Esther this morning. How many of you have ever done a study through the book of Esther? Not many. So how many of you are familiar with the contents? You know the story? Okay. When I was a boy growing up in Jewish community, the holiday that you most look forward to was not Hanukkah, believe it or not, because we never got real great gifts anyway. That's always the joke, you know, eight cheap gifts. The holiday you mostly look forward to was Purim. And Purim was every March. And in the synagogue, which in Phoenix was the Jewish Community Center, there's always a big celebration. It's a lot of fun. And it's the story of Esther. The book of Esther ends with the banquet they called Purim. And so when I was about 10, I remember, and you'd put on a Purim play every year, so the kids would reenact parts of Esther. So the year I was in the play, I was appointed to be narrator. So I still remember, you know how you always remember your embarrassing moments as a child? You can forget like 2 years in your life, but that embarrassing moment stays with you. So and it was a pretty big auditorium, and the curtains open, and I was supposed to walk up and then introduce the play, and I had like 5 sheets of paper, and I get up to the mic, and I'm already extremely nervous, and I drop the papers. So as I'm picking them up, they're not in order. So I still can remember to this day shuffling through, everybody looking, trying to get them in order. Of course, the parents don't care, but you think it's the end of the world. So, but Purim was the celebration we look most forward to. And we're going to talk about how this book ends with Purim. Now, I have a daunting task. I've got about 35 minutes to get through a fairly long book. So we don't really have time to read through much. But what I want to do is give you a sense of the book so in your own reading and study, you have an outline and sort of a overview of what's going on. The author is unknown. The timeline of the book, and I don't mean when it was written, but when the events occurred, is the reign of Xerxes. Xerxes is the king in Persia in the book, and he reigned from 486 to 465. So sometime in that time frame. The historical situation, we've talked about the exile to Babylon. And after the end of that exile at 70 years, Babylon was taken over by Persia. Persia was now the ruler of the world. And the Jews were allowed to return to Jerusalem. And you read about that in Ezra and Nehemiah, the return to Israel. Well, not all the Jews returned to Jerusalem. A lot of them stayed in what is now Persia. But Persia stopped the flow of the Jews to Jerusalem after a few. They allowed immigration for a while, then they stopped it. So the rest of the Jews had to stay in Persia anyway, though most of them had chosen to. They were fairly safe in Persia generally. Obviously, in the events of the book, we'll change that. But up until the time of Haman's plot, they were fairly safe. Now, Esther is a unique book in the Bible because it's famous for one thing. It's the only book of the Bible that never mentions God. Not once. And not only does it never mention God, it never mentions anything spiritual. Israel is not mentioned. The Bible or the Old Testament or any book of the Old Testament or a prophet or Moses. Nothing's mentioned. Abraham's not mentioned. The word prayer is not mentioned. It's simply a story of events with no spiritual words, even God. And so some have wondered why that is. If it's the book of the Bible, it is about God. Why God is not mentioned once? Well, the answer is there's a theological reason, and the theological reason is then the literary reason why to not mention God. And that is that Israel is outside of God's theocratic presence. They're outside of Israel. They've been exiled. That was called a curse. And so it seems as if God is absent. It's as if God isn't there because they're really far away in this foreign country on their own. And so the literary decision not to mention God fits what the book is trying to say. Because the question the book raises is God still the God of Israel, even for us way out here in Persia? Is God still with us? And what about his promises to Israel? Remember, Israel was supposed to bring forth a deliverer, a Messiah. Is that still going to happen? Or has he forgotten us? So the question, has God forgotten us, goes with the literary technique, which is to only have God behind the scenes, but don't mention him at all. And so what this is about then, it's going to show God's providence in bringing about his promise as though you never actually see the word God or Jehovah or anything mentioned. Now, it's interesting that the Jews didn't have a problem with this in adding this to the canon. In other words, to add this to the Old Testament, the Jews didn't say, you know, God is not even mentioned in this book. Maybe it's not inspired. The Jews understood what was happening and easily in the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, added Esther. So there wasn't a big controversy simply because God isn't mentioned. And so let's walk through the book, and I'll ask you a few questions for those who have read it or studied it before. And there's 7 parts to the book. Does that surprise you? A lot of books have, Revelation has 7 parts, 7. Now, if you want to, you can open your Bibles and sort of walk through with me the book of Esther. But like I said, it's going to be more of an overview, so we're going to be looking at it fairly quickly. And what I want to show you then at the end is the eschatology of Esther. And so it begins in chapter 1 with the glory of Xerxes' kingdom. If you want to turn there, look, somebody read verses 1 through 8, if you don't mind. What is this first section trying to demonstrate? Yeah, how great Xerxes' kingdom was, right? Yes, I mean, it goes into detail of the glory and splendor. Notice verse 4. The royal glory and splendor and pomp of his greatness. And so Susa, again, Persia ruled the world at this time. And so taxes were coming in from all over the world to support Persia, and especially Susa, the capital. So it was going to build palaces. And so Xerxes was very rich. If you've seen the movie 300, that's Xerxes. And that actually fits a time frame in here we don't have time for. And so that's the pomp of Xerxes' kingdom. And so it goes out of its way. By the way, in our day we would say he ruled from Pakistan to Sudan. If you can imagine that on a map. The Middle East, Pakistan, and then down to Africa and Sudan. That's how great his kingdom was. And that was most of the world. And so you have the opulence of Susa, and it becomes a pseudo-heaven. In other words, God had promised heaven for his people, but it seems like heaven has been found here in Susa, the way it's described. It's a glorious place. Mother of pearl, marble, verse 6, precious stones. And so if you're a Jew reading this, you think, that was supposed to be us. And now it's our enemies. And now it's the idol worshippers. Now, Xerxes' edict is the next part of, and chapter 1 to 2:7 is sort of the plot that sets up the plot. It's the first plot. So, Xerxes, you know what happens with Queen Vashti, right? Xerxes wants to, by the way, one of the things we found in history is that the kings in those days loved to make laws when they were drunk. So they would have banquets, they would make some kind of a decision, and then they'd wake up the next morning to find out what they decided. That's actually not unusual. So, yeah, late night tweet. So Xerxes wants to show off his wife. Probably in those days they had harems. They didn't have just one queen. There was a harem of queens normally. But Vashti must have been the best one in his mind. And so he wants to show her off. And you know what happens when he wants to show her off. Verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. And you know why eunuchs were in charge of the harem, right? Okay. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. Now, there's a lot of humor in chapter 1 and irony. The humor is Xerxes is this great, most powerful king in the world, but who can he control? His own wife, his own queen. And so that kind of irony, you know, remember, this is looking at it from a believer's perspective. Is this the true king? No, look at his kingdom, his most close allies, his, even his wife doesn't listen to him. And so she refuses to be paraded in front of all the men, especially drunk men, and you don't blame her, obviously. That was not a nice thing. And so Xerxes gives one of his edicts. How many of you have heard of the phrase, the law of the Medes and the Persians? What does that mean, Jonathan? Yeah, it's irrevocable, irretractable law. Once the king made an edict, even he couldn't retract it. It was considered the word of God. And that's one of the questions of the book. Whose word is truly irrevocable, Xerxes or Jehovah's? That's the question the book is going to raise, because we see all these edicts coming from Xerxes. Now, this one is sort of humorous, because what he says is he wants everyone to know that the queen is banished, and so all the other wives won't rebel against their husbands. So we need to keep the wives in check, so we need to scare them. Look at verse 20. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. Now, why is this humorous? Well, you need an edict for the wives to honor their husbands, right? You need to sort of scare them into it. They weren't doing it naturally, that you needed a law. And so already we're seeing the limits of Xerxes, not quite as impressive as we would imagine. And so notice how fragile in verse 18 the kingdom is. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. As soon as all the wives of the land hear that Vashti said no, they're all going to say no. There's this great fear among all the men. So let's do another edict. See, this is they're being made fun of. The power of the men, the power of the king are being made fun of by the author as we see this. And so Xerxes thinks he can control them. Now that's sort of the setup to the main conflict. The main conflict obviously is not the women or Vashti. It's going to be about the Jews. But that sort of opens the story to set up what's going to happen. So because of this, he chooses a new queen. Now, some historians have said Esther cannot have happened because we don't have records of a queen Esther in Persia. But remember that the king, and we know this of Xerxes, they had harems. And many of the best ones were his favorite were called queens. And so Esther was chosen as the next one. And now it becomes there's another plot within the plot, and that's Mordecai. Mordecai is Esther's cousin. Sometimes people say she's uncles because there's an age difference, but actually the Bible says they're cousins. But Mordecai learns about a plot, and that's in chapter 2, verse 19. He learns about a plot to kill Xerxes. And so he reports it, and they find the assassins, and Xerxes' life is saved. And that raises the question now, will this be a Jew raised now to a position of influence? That's what we expect, because Mordecai has just saved Xerxes' life. But what happens at the end is nothing happens to Mordecai. He's completely forgotten. The person who actually informed the king was forgotten, and we'll see that later. Verse 23 of chapter 2, when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So the story was recorded. Xerxes, like a lot of kings, forgot the details. So Mordecai is not raised to a position of influence. Now that brings the main plot as the conflict unfolds. And then a man named Haman appears, sort of the right hand of the king. Haman is an Amalekite. Does anyone remember the Amalekites in the Bible? It's important to know the history. Robert, do you remember? When Israel was on their way to the Promised Land, who tried to kill the Israelites? The Amalekites. So God had cursed the Amalekites. Most of them were wiped out, especially under David. There are a few remained. Haman is one of those. So Haman would have a deep historical hatred for the Jews, because we're talking about enemies of thousands of years. And back then, it was like the Hatfields and McCoys. You know, you kept your hatreds generations on end. So Haman would already hate the Jews, and Mordecai would have no love for an Amalekite, for Haman. So what happens to you who know the story? Haman comes by, everybody bows because he's important. Who doesn't bow? Mordecai doesn't bow, and Haman is enraged when he finds out that this Jew didn't bow to me. So that brings us to chapter 3, verse 7. And the story jumps 5 years since Esther became queen. Now, why was Esther chosen, by the way? Yeah, she was her looks. So she was beautiful. What we're not told about Esther is where she's at in all this. Some assume that she was sort of kidnapped against her will. Others, this would have been, for most women, non-believing, one of the highest honors you could have. I mean, you were treated like a queen, and you were pampered with the riches of the land. We don't know where Esther's at. Is she pretty much in her mind like the pagans, or has she still retained her faith? We won't know till chapter 4. So one of the keys to the book in chapter 3 is Haman wants to kill the Jews. He knows how many Jews have come from the exile and have stayed. And now that he's in this high position authority, especially after Mordecai has insulted him, he wants to kill the Jews. So in verse 7, it says, they cast lots. That Hebrew word for lots is Purim. So that's where we get the festival of Purim, the festival of lots, as it's sometimes called. And why is he casting lots? Anyone remember? He has a plan in mind to destroy all the Jews, and he wants to come up with a time that the gods would give him to do this. So he has his servants cast lots, and there's a certain day and month picked. And then he comes up with the idea. Verse 9, he says to Xerxes, if it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. Notice verse 8. Haman said to the king, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not the king's profit to tolerate them. Now, there's a lot of lying in this. They weren't rebellious against the king's laws. This is the same thing they accused Christ of, right? And so, notice how he doesn't even say who it is to Xerxes. That's how powerful Xerxes is. He hears about, can we destroy this group? And they have a lot of money right now. We could put all their money into your treasury. And so, what does Xerxes say in verse 11? By the way, this is a chilling verse. Notice how the king doesn't even know who he's talking about. What ethnic group? This is genocide. Haman is saying genocide, that there's a day where we can all be allowed to kill this one group. And the king says, whatever you want. Now that's incredible power, but that's incredible evil, isn't it? To not even care. Now, he doesn't know what about these people. It's his favorite wife's people. That's what he'll learn later on. And of course, Haman does not want the king to know this. And so he leaves out any details. So now we have the main conflict, the main plot. We have this age-old enemy of Israel. Now, obviously, Satan is using him to destroy the Jews. Because if the Jews in Persia are allowed to be destroyed, it's anywhere. And what would that include? Well, who would that include? Who can be killed? Yeah, the exiles who have gone back, because Persia owned all the land. Israel was part of Persia now. So it wasn't just within the city limits of Susa, it was the whole land. So this would be the end of all the Jews. And what did Satan want? He wanted all the Jews dead. Why? What did Satan know? Because the Messiah was promised to be born a Jew. And so Satan is trying to destroy God's plan of salvation. Now, it's interesting that this all depends on when the lots are cast. There's a famous verse that raises a question, Proverbs 16:33. So the question is the Lord behind all this? Where is God in all this? Xerxes' power seems limitless. What is God going to do? Is he watching? Is he really in charge of this lot throwing even? That's the question the book is going to raise, and it's obviously going to answer it. All right, part three is the middle of the book, which is chapter four, Esther's decision to intervene. Mordecai comes to Esther and says, "You have the king's ear, go to him and plead with him to stop this. Save our people." Now, Esther is reluctant at first. Why? Say it again. Okay, it is hard, but even more than hard, what is it? It's illegal if you're not summoned. You can't on your own go to the king. If the king doesn't summon you and you approach him, you're put to death. Esther knows that. So Mordecai is basically giving Esther a potentially suicidal mission. Now, what we don't know is how much Esther loves her life. I mean, again, she would be the envy of every woman in Persia. She would be covered with the greatest perfumes, clothing, honor, fear. And yet, what does she decide? Famous verse, of course, is verses 15 and 16. The whole book sort of changes on these two verses. These words, by the way, have captured the heart of the church for thousands of years. Verse 16. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." You've probably heard that verse before, right? That's the famous verse from Esther. If I perish, I perish. Now again, the author doesn't want to use spiritual words like prayer, but when Esther calls for a fast, she's not concerned with dieting, right? Why do you fast if you're a Jew? You devote it to prayer. So it's another way to say, everybody pray. But the author only mentions the fast part in line with the way the book is written. So Esther steps in and decides, and turn to the back of your notes, to save her people. Now, part four is chapter five. Again, we saw why the move is so risky. But she does this in a very wise and careful way. She asks the king to hold a banquet. And she's just approaching this with a lot of wisdom. You know, you're going to soften up the king. It's like when you're a kid, you want to ask your parents for something, you want to make sure they're in a good mood, that type thing. So this is sort of what's happening. She wants to make sure that he's going to be ready. Now, banquets are a key theme in Esther. The book of Esther begins with a banquet. There are two banquets right in the middle here. And how does it end? With a banquet. And so banquets are sort of the brackets of the book as well as right in the middle. And so whose banquet? Who's going to throw the final banquet is sort of one of the questions. And so you remember what happened. Haman's plan to kill Mordecai. He's really angry about all this, but notice at the end of verse of chapter 5, he's so angry with Mordecai. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 feet high, cubits high, be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." So Haman is invited to the feast that Esther is going to throw, but he's still angry at Mordecai, so they set up gallows. And notice again, his wife is sort of commanding him. That's another irony of what's been going on here. Now, in chapter 6, we start seeing God's plan unfold. God brings something very unusual about, unexpected, and that the king has insomnia. It must not have been normal because it tells us that. So the king can't sleep, and he decides to read what? The records of what's happened in his palace the last 5 or 10 years. Remember, that was written down, what Mordecai did. And as he's reading, by the way, why is all this happening? Did he just happen to pick up that book? Or was God overseeing all this? So you see God's providence without having to say, and God put it in the king. You're supposed to read between the lines. So he reads about Mordecai. He asks this ironic question to Haman. Do you remember the question? If you found out somebody saved your life, what would you do for him? And somebody really helped you. Now, Haman thinks it's him. So he says, "I would give him the greatest honors. I'd have a parade for him and all these things." And he says, "Okay, we'll do this for Mordecai." Of course, Haman is just slayed at that moment. And so now he realizes he's in trouble, but it's going to get worse, isn't it? Because Esther is going to plead with the king and is going to say to the king, "Please don't do this. That plan you have for this such and such a day, those are my people. And you'd be wiping out my people," which would include who? Esther. If it's going to happen, it's to all of them. That includes me. So now the king's really angry, and Haman knows he's in trouble. So you remember the story. Haman goes into the queen. He gets on his knees, and he pleads with her. Xerxes walks in, and he thinks what? He thinks that Haman's trying to molest, take advantage of her. So then he says, "Have him hung." There just happened to be gallows that were already ready for a hanging, and it was Mordecai's. And Haman is hung on those very gallows. So the first conflict is solved, resolved by the Lord's providence working all that out behind the scenes. But you still have a problem, and that is the law has already gone out into the land. Everybody has read the edict that on such and such a day, you're allowed to kill all Jewish people. And you can take their money, and whatever's left will go to the king. So the law was there, and what's the law of the Medes and Persians? You can't change it. And who even can't change it? The king. Because he would be admitting he's fallible if he changed his own law. And if he wanted them to believe he was under God, the Persian god, and so he couldn't change the law. So now you've got another dilemma. And what's Esther's solution? Do you remember? On that day, make it legal for all the Jews to protect themselves and kill anyone who's trying to kill them. And therefore, they will not be charged with any crime of murder if they kill anyone they know is thinking of killing them. Now, he could add that to the original edict without changing, without revoking the edict. So a new edict goes out. To protect that they can do that. Oh, it's in chapter 8, starting verse 9, is the edict. And then I'm picking up in verse 10. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. Now, you could say, well, how would the Jews still defend themselves? As soon as the people saw this unusual second edict, they started to fear doing anything. So most of them didn't want anything to do with this. This sounds bad that the king is all of a sudden showing favor to these people. But there were a group that still tried to kill the Jews, and you know what happened, right? The Jews defeated their enemies. We don't have any indication that they actually killed the women and children like the king said they could. But Mordecai was allowed to plunder the Jews, to plunder the enemies, and he didn't. And that's interesting. That's one of the rules of holy war in Deuteronomy, not to take it. So anyway, Esther then requested an extra day of war at the end. She said, let us have another day where we can avenge ourselves. And the king gave her a second day, which is, again, adding to the edict. It's not revoking it. Haman's sons are hanged, and it wasn't vindictive. It was to defeat all the enemies. And so at the end, you have the conclusion. Part 7 of the book is the Feast of Purim. And that starts in verse 20. Some of your Bibles actually have that, right? The Feast of Purim inaugurated. And so all the way really to the end of the book is the Feast of Purim and all the celebrations around it. And that's why if you go to a synagogue in any March of the year, they're going to be celebrating the Feast of Purim. And they celebrated that in Jesus' day also. It was when God saved his people from being annihilated. Now let's look at the eschatology in Esther. By the way, any questions on the outline of the book? Hopefully you can use this and then go back and read the details we couldn't get to, because it's a wonderful book. First, Esther is a type of Christ. Esther was willing to give her life to save her people. She knew she may die. And so she is picturing what Christ would do for his people on the cross. God will bring his people to a true paradise. The book of Esther opens with a pseudo-paradise. God's people are promised a genuine paradise that will last. And we certainly see that by the end of the book. The Messiah will come and bring us to that Eden that was promised that we've talked about all year. Number 3, God will reverse the curse for his people. The basic theme in Esther is reversal. Everything at the beginning of the book is reversed by the end of the book. Esther begins being a nothing. No one knows her. By the end of the book, she's an honored queen. Mordecai is a nobody. By the end of the book, if you read chapter 10, it's all about Mordecai being honored in the records of Persia. Haman is beginning of the book. He's high and lifted up as the right hand of the king. By the end of the book, what? He's high and lifted up, all right. He's hung on the gallows. And the irony, the very gallows that he had built for Mordecai. The Jews at the beginning are a minority that's persecuted. The very fact that Haman could do this, they're almost killed. They're one edict away almost from being killed. By the end, the Jews are exalted and their enemies are killed. Everything is reversed in the book. In the beginning, there's a feast for all the unbelievers. They're all in this drunken spree. It's probably much worse than you think. At the end of the book, God's people are celebrating, thanking God in a banquet. And so there's a feast at the beginning and there's a feast at the end. Purim reverses the first banquet. At the beginning, Satan seems to be winning. Nothing seems to be happening right for God's people with Haman and Xerxes. By the end, Satan loses. And though God's never mentioned, it's very clear he's fulfilling his promise behind the scenes. And so God seems distant in the book, even the way it's written. And by the end, we see that God is not distant. He's very active in the salvation and protection of his people, even in a foreign country. And so that reminds us of the great reversal of the Christian life, right? Romans 8. We suffer now, and we enter that marriage banquet of the feast, the time of glory. That reversal is the theme of the book. That's why you can see eschatology in Esther. It's pointing us ahead to the true Esther that would come down and lead us to that eschatological, that final banquet, that marriage supper that's greater than anything Xerxes could throw. It's really sad that the Jewish people only see this as a political book. And they don't see Christ in it. They don't see heaven. They only see it as a promise for future political victory. But as Christians, we see Christ. A great book, if you want a commentary, is Karen Jacobs. She is a Westminster Seminary grad, PhD there. She's a great commentator. She has a commentary on, it's the new, what is it? Someone tell me. It's the NIV Application Bible, if I remember right. She has a commentary on Esther that's very good. Yes. I mean, Karen Jobes, I'm sorry. Yes, Karen Jobes. A lot of OPC women's studies go through Karen Jobes' Esther book, sort of written for a Bible study. All right, let's pray.